Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is committed to bringing you the stories and perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. From the peace activists demanding an end to war, to indigenous leaders fighting to stop fossil fuel extraction and save the planet. Our independent reporting is only possible because we're funded by you, not by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war or gun violence, not by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover the climate crisis. We count on your generous support to keep Democracy Now! Going. Please make your donation of $5, $10, or more at democracynow.org. Every dollar counts. Thank you so much. We're counting on you. Stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
You think about this race replacement theory that he talked about in this manifesto. There are people who are pushing this hatred on these young people, indoctrinating their minds to go out and commit violence.
President Biden's visiting Buffalo today, 2 days after an 18-year-old white supremacist killed 10 people at a supermarket in the heart of the black community. We'll speak to Rashad Robinson of Color of Change and Talia Levin, author of Culture Warlords, My Journey into the Dark Web of White Supremacy.
So when you have a political movement that consistently portrays demographic change, specifically the change that white people will become a demographic minority in America as apocalyptic, and the mere presence and birth of non-white people as a threat, an existential threat. Those are the preconditions for violence. That's annihilatory rhetoric.
Plus, we look at monopolies and the baby formula shortage. As parents scramble to find formula to feed their babies across the United States, we'll look at how the crisis is linked to the fact that just four companies sell almost all the baby formula in the country. A whistleblower had warned about problems at Abbott's largest baby formula plant last October, but the FDA took months to interview the whistleblower, who was fired by Abbott. We'll speak to David Dayan of the American Prospect. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's visiting Buffalo today as families there mourn the victims of Saturday's massacre, when a white 18-year-old suspect killed 10 people at a supermarket he deliberately targeted in the city's black community. Investigators say the shooter spent months carefully planning his assault and intended to continue his rampage with an attack on a second location. Amidst the mourning, calls for justice are growing. Civil rights lawyer Ben Crump spoke in Buffalo Monday.
What happened on Saturday was an act of domestic terrorism. And we have to define it as such. We can't sugarcoat it. We can't try to explain it away, talking about mental illness. No, this was an act of domestic terrorism perpetrated by a young white supremacist.
We'll have the latest on the Buffalo massacre after headlines. In California, officials in Orange County say Sunday's mass shooting at a church in Laguna Woods was a politically motivated hate crime targeting the Taiwanese community.
It is believed the suspect involved was upset about political tensions between China and Taiwan.
Police named the suspect, 68-year-old David Cho of Las Vegas, a Chinese immigrant and U.S. citizen. He reportedly placed Molotov cocktails around the church and chained exit doors shut before opening fire on a congregation gathered for a luncheon. Dr. John Chang died in the assault. Four others were rushed to the hospital with gunshot wounds. On Monday, Orange County officials hailed Dr. Chang as a hero who rushed the gunman, giving others a chance to subdue their attacker. President Joe Biden has approved a Pentagon plan to redeploy up to 500 U.S. troops to Somalia. The move largely reverses a withdrawal ordered by then-President Trump during his final days in office. The Pentagon says the troops are needed to train Somalia's army to combat al-Shabaab militants. The Pentagon's announcement came just after Hassan Sheikh Mohamed was sworn in as Somalia's president, a post he previously held from 2012 to 2017. In news from Ukraine, more than 260 Ukrainian troops have been evacuated from the besieged Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol, ending a week-long standoff. About 50 injured Ukrainian fighters were taken to a hospital in the Russian-controlled town of Novoastok. The other fighters were taken to another town under Russian control. With the plant evacuated, Russia now controls all of Mariupol, which has been left in ruins after months of fighting. The standoff at the steel plant lasted 4 months. The U.S. Senate has voted to advance a $40 billion military and economic aid package for Ukraine by a vote of 81-11, the Senate agreed to limit debate on the bill, setting up its passage, which is expected on Wednesday. The entire Democratic caucus supported the measure. The 11 no votes came from Republicans, including Senator Rand Paul, who temporarily stalled passage of the $40 billion package last week. Paul accused Senate leaders of trying to ram through the spending bill without any oversight on how the money is being spent. Russian President Vladimir Putin has said Russia can accept Finland and Sweden joining NATO, but not if new military bases are set up in the two countries.
As for the expansion of NATO, including through new members of the alliance, Finland and Sweden, Russia wants to inform you that it has no problems with these states, none. And so, in this sense, there is no immediate threat to Russia from an expansion of NATO to include these countries. But the expansion of military infrastructure into this territory would certainly provoke our response. What that response will be, we will see what threats are created for us.
On Monday, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan hinted he may block Sweden and Finland from joining NATO, but many analysts expect Turkey to back down in exchange for some concessions. Turkey's accused both countries of supporting the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is banned in Turkey. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has tested positive for COVID-19, is isolating at home with moderate symptoms. Ardern's government oversaw one of the world's most successful campaigns to stamp out the coronavirus until a wave of Omicron infections earlier this year forced New Zealand to abandon its zero COVID strategy. More than 80% of New Zealand's population is fully vaccinated, and the nation's per capita death rate from COVID is nearly 16 times lower than the U.S. In China, authorities say Shanghai has achieved zero COVID status after no new cases of community spread were detected for 3 consecutive days. This comes as a lockdown affecting some 25 million Shanghai residents is now in its 7th week. Public health restrictions across China this year have impacted hundreds of millions of people, driving the official unemployment rate to more than 6% in April. That's China's highest jobless rate since February 2020. Here in New York City, public health officials strongly recommended Monday people wear medical-grade masks indoors, but stopped short of ordering a mask mandate. The warning came as New York prepared to raise its COVID alert level to high for the second time this month. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports the Food and Drug Administration's poised to authorize third-dose booster shots of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children age 5 to 11. Across the U.S., coronavirus hospitalizations are continuing to rise, with public health officials warning the nearly 100,000 new cases reported each day represents a significant undercount. The Supreme Court's conservative majority has sided with Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz in a case challenging a federal anti-bribery law. Writing for the majority in Monday's 6-3 opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts ruled that the First Amendment's guarantee of free speech protects the right of a candidate to use unlimited post-election contributions to repay loans made to their campaign. The federal campaign finance law, known as the McCain-Feingold Act, previously capped such loans at $250,000. In her dissent, Justice Elena Kagan wrote, quote, "The theory of the legislation is easy to grasp. Political contributions that will line a candidate's own pockets, given after his election to office, pose a significant danger of corruption," she said. The Biden administration's easing Trump-era restrictions on travel between the United States and Cuba. The State Department said Monday it'll reinstate the Cuba Family Reunification Parole Program, expanding visa processing and making it easier for families to visit relatives in Cuba. The administration's also lifting a $1,000 cap on remittances family members can send to relatives in Cuba. The new measures fall short of U.S.-Cuban rapprochement seen under former President Obama. In occupied East Jerusalem, dozens of Palestinians were injured Monday as Israeli forces used rubber-coated steel bullets, tear gas, and foul-smelling skunk water to attack a funeral procession of a Palestinian man killed by Israeli soldiers. On Saturday, Walid al-Sharif succumbed to wounds he suffered April 22nd when Israeli troops shot him in the head with a rubber-coated bullet as they fired so-called less lethal munitions at worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. An eyewitness said Israeli forces left al-Sharif bleeding for nearly half an hour before he was finally taken to the hospital in a coma. He's among 54 Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since the beginning of the year. Meanwhile, the Catholic Church's top official in Jerusalem has condemned Israeli police for their violent attack on last Friday's funeral for Shireen Abu Akleh. The veteran Al Jazeera journalist was killed last week covering an Israeli raid in the West Bank in an attack Palestinians and Al Jazeera blame on Israeli military snipers. Archbishop Pier Battista Pizzaballa said on Monday, "Israel's attack on Shireen Abu Akleh's funeral was a severe violation of international norms and regulations."
The police stormed into a Christian health institute, disrespecting the church, disrespecting the health institute, disrespecting the memory of the deceased, and forcing the pallbearers almost to drop the coffin. Israeli police invasion and disproportionate use of force, attacking mourners, striking them with batons, using smoke grenades, shooting rubber bullets, frightening the hospital patients, is a severe violation of international norms and regulations.
In Lebanon, Hezbollah and its political allies have lost their majority in parliament after final results from Sunday's election showed no outright winner. The inconclusive outcome leaves Lebanon's parliament split among several camps, even as the nation grapples with soaring inflation, rampant poverty and corruption. It was Lebanon's first election since a devastating economic collapse in 2019 and the massive 2020 explosion at the port of Beirut that killed at least 215 people while destroying entire neighborhoods. Sri Lanka's newly sworn-in prime minister has warned his nation is down to a one-day supply of gasoline as a devastating economic crisis is set to deepen. Ranil Wickremesinghe said Monday Sri Lanka's government will have to print money to pay government wages, even though it'll lead to the devaluation of the currency. He said Sri Lanka will seek to privatize its state-owned airline and called on citizens to accept even deeper austerity measures.
The next couple of months will be the most difficult ones of our lives. We must prepare ourselves to make some sacrifices and face the challenges of this period. I have no desire to hide the truth and to lie to the public. Although these facts are unpleasant and terrifying, this is the true situation.
In recent weeks, Sri Lanka has been rocked by protests demanding the ouster of the president, Mahinda Rajapaksa, among rolling blackouts, soaring inflation, and shortages for fuel, medicine, and water. Back in the United States, the Biden administration's announced a number of steps to alleviate a critical nationwide shortage of baby formula. The Food and Drug Administration and Abbott Laboratories have reached an agreement to allow Abbott to reopen the nation's largest baby formula plant, which was closed after due to concerns over bacterial contamination following the deaths of two babies. Meanwhile, the FDA has eased import rules on baby formula made overseas, and the American Academy of Pediatrics has said babies as young as 6 months old can now be fed cow's milk for a brief period of time due to the baby formula shortage. Up until now, pediatricians had recommended babies not be fed cow's milk until they are 1 year old. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. And the longtime LGBTQ lawyer and activist Irva Shuvad has died at the age of 63. From 1989 to 1992, she headed the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and became an outspoken critic of the federal government's response to the AIDS crisis. In 1990, she interrupted a speech by President George H.W. Bush while holding a sign that read, "Talk is cheap, AIDS funding is not." She appeared on Democracy Now! In 2009.
I feel that, you know, as a woman of color, it's not really separable for me. Racial justice, gay rights, social justice, economic justice, they're intertwined. And the context that we live in requires, I think, the gay movement to see how intertwined our struggle is with the defeat of right-wing values and right-wing ideology.
To see our whole interview with Irva Shuvad, you can go to our website. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we turn to the Buffalo Massacre as President Biden visits the city today. Stay with us. There's a New Day Coming by Menahan Street Band featuring Sondra Williams. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, President Biden is visiting Buffalo today, meet with families mourning the victims of Saturday's massacre, when a white 18-year-old suspect killed 10 people at a supermarket in the heart of Buffalo's black community. As families plan funerals, calls for justice are growing. Civil rights lawyer Ben Crump spoke Monday alongside the son and daughter of the oldest victim, 86-year-old Ruth Whitfield.
There's nothing we can do that's going to take away the hurt, take away these tears, take away the pain, take away the hole in our hearts, because part of us is gone, senselessly taken from us by hate.
He took away my mother and my best friend. How dare you? How dare you? This needs to be fixed. ASAP.
Amen.
Mom, we love you. Thank you.
You think about this race replacement theory that he talked about in this manifesto. There are people who are pushing this hatred on these young people, indoctrinating their minds to go out and commit violence. I mean, these politicians who are trying to, you know, use fear to inspire their base, to help get cable news ratings. It's these people who are accomplices to this mass murder. And Cliff, even though they may not have pulled the trigger, they did load the gun for this young white supremacist. They loaded the gun. And we have to hold them accountable, too.
So that's Ben Crump. And before that, Robin and Garnell Whitfield. They lost Ruth Whitfield, the oldest at 86 of the victims in the massacre on Saturday. Garnell Whitfield is also the former fire commissioner of Buffalo. The Whitfield family and others may sue Bushmaster, the company that makes the assault-style weapon used in the Buffalo attack, which Crump, Biden and others are calling an act of domestic terrorism. The alleged gunman told investigators he was filled with hate toward black people. His online record shows he'd been previously studying hate attacks. He posted a 180-page manifesto citing racist replacement theories and had the number 14 stenciled on the barrel of his gun, which is reportedly a reference to a 14-word white supremacist phrase. He live-streamed the attack on Twitch, which our next guest tweeted about. Color of Change President Rashad Robinson tweeted, "Twitch took down the live-stream of the white supremacist shooting in Buffalo in under 2 minutes. Meanwhile, the video is now on Facebook with 1.8 million views, and they're not removing it because it doesn't violate their terms of service," Rashad says. Color of Change has called for social media platforms to institute changes to their terms of service in order to keep us safe, saying, quote, "There is a direct through line between the tech industry's lack of regulation and the anti-black violence we saw in Buffalo." Rashad Robinson, welcome back to Democracy Now! If
you
could start off by responding to what happened, and then most specifically, because we are seeing massacre after massacre, and of course, this one is so reminiscent of what happened at Mother Emanuel in South Carolina a few years ago, the targeting of the black community. We understand that the white supremacist teenager who did this had also considered schools and churches, but was afraid of security.
Well, I mean, for all of us, this is both incredibly sad, but it also makes us deeply angry because of all of the things that could be and should have been done to deal with the climate that fuels this type of violence. At the end of the day, whole incentive structure, a whole profit incentive structure, which has both incentivized the type of content and disinformation and hate-filled rhetoric that we see online. We have watched social media platforms refuse to deal with this because self-regulated companies are unregulated companies. I have went before Congress to try to push members of Congress to actually deal with the immunity that these platforms have over this type of content. And it's not simply about freedom of speech, Amy. This is about what they amplify. This is what they, this is about the content that they serve up to users as they sign on. This is about all of the ways in which their product is designed in order to create people to have more time on these platforms, more engagement on these platforms, to be engaged in more hate-filled rhetoric. And at the end of the day, we are watching, we are seeing firsthand the impact of it. We should not have to go to billionaires to beg them to protect our civil rights. Our government should be doing the work to hold corporations accountable, and right now they are not doing it. And at the end of the day, we live, exist in a climate. It's not just the social media platforms. It's also Fox News. It's also the ways in which the big carriers, cable carriers, the Verizons and Comcast of the world, pay more money for Fox News than they do for other cable programs. And so people should have a choice and should be able to not actually have Fox News. We should be able to drive down the profits of Fox News, but we can't because 90% of their money comes actually from carrier services.
carrier fees, not from advertisers. So there's so much at stake here. But at the end of the day, what folks should recognize is that there is an incentive structure. There is a team. There are players. There are coaches. There are owners. And this killer did not act alone. He is part of a larger network. And until we deal with the incentive structure, we will see more of this.
And Rashad, could you talk about Twitch, the platform that many people are unfamiliar with that enabled the shooter to live stream this attack? Explain what the platform is and how he used it.
Well, Twitch is a platform that allows creators to post and engage platforms. It allows people to monetize in different ways their creativity. We've been actually running a campaign with Black Twitch creators because of all of the sort of hate attacks and the raids that have happened on their chats and on their channels. And what we've seen is an inability of Twitch to do anything about it. We've been back and forth with Twitch. We've demanded racial equity audits of Twitch. We have been engaged to try to push this platform to actually do better. And so for us, the engagement at Color of Change with Twitch did not start recently. We have been engaged. We have been warning Twitch. We have recognized how their platform was used and how it's become a home, a safe haven for the type of hate, for folks that actually know that they can engage in this type of behavior and not be held accountable. But at the end of the day, these platforms get to do it because they believe that they are protected. And in essence, they have been protected by a set of laws that actually give them, in some ways, immunity over being held accountable liably in all sorts of ways. And so until we actually deal with the incentive structures, until we create more accountability over the algorithms. And I know folks are wondering, like, this technology is so complicated. Well, we've had complicated things over time. And what folks should recognize as we think about sort of what does it mean to regulate these companies? What does it mean to hold these companies accountable? Our cars are not safe. Our seatbelts don't work because of the benevolence of the auto industry. They work because there is government infrastructure and regulation. And there are consequences when those things do not work, when standards are not met. Right now, folks can go out to Silicon Valley, call themselves engineers, and build all sorts of things without any rules or regulations or accountability for what they build. And so right now, the technology that should be bringing us into the future and bringing us in together is dragging us into the past. And it's doing that not as an accident, but because we have a set of rules or a lack of rules that are manufacturing all of the things that we're seeing.
But Rashad, I wanted to ask you, how do you draw the line between being able to regulate these companies and at the same time allow for legitimate dissent and for dissent not to be not to be closed down by these companies at the same time? I'm thinking, for instance, even now with the situation with Elon Musk taking over Twitter, and he's going in the opposite direction, insisting on more freedom on these platforms. Mm-hmm.
Well, people use the word freedom, and it only means freedom for some, right? If the ability of certain people in our communities to be able to go to a grocery store or to go to a church is diminished because of a climate for profit that is created, that actually doesn't make us more free. But, you know, to the extent that we're not talking about here about whether or not someone should be able to post things that we may not like or we might find distasteful. What we are talking about is algorithmic amplification. We are talking about how these platforms put energy behind making some type of content travel because that type of content creates more energy. So an example is on Facebook. If Facebook tomorrow decided that they were going to just make it so you spend more time looking at your friends and family, even if your friends and family are sometimes sharing things that are distasteful, that would diminish greatly the type of content that is hate-filled. But in fact, what they are incentivizing is us all being part of groups where people are arguing. Because, or if we see a piece of content and maybe engage in it, even if we don't join that group, it gets served up to us. And what we know is that this is all part of the larger scheme at these platforms to keep us on the platforms longer, to keep us engaged there longer, because it drives up their profits. And they can do that because at the end of the day, that they don't actually have accountability. So now imagine a company that produces meat saying that, you know what, we just want to give consumers more choice. So we're going to put some meat on the supermarket counters that's actually safe. And we're going to put some that, you know, is a couple of months old. And, you know, you pick. We just want to give people choice. Those companies would be held accountable. What we are dealing with is not simply, you know, these ideas of what people are posting. What we are dealing with is the back-end business models that are creating a structure where certain things are being able to be profited from, certain things travel differently, and hate-filled content has more of a space to be engaged with. And that's what we are talking about. If these companies had a level of accountability, you better believe that the innovators in Silicon Valley would figure out how to engage. I think that there is this idea that regulation and accountability stifles innovation. But what we know is that climate innovation has helped in so many ways give us new types of vehicles and new types of ways to actually move from place to place. Innovation can both make us safe and it can actually spark or regulation can make us safe and help us be more innovative. And that's what we have to focus on. But at the end of the day, none of us should have to rely on Mark Zuckerberg or Twitch, which is owned by Amazon, or all of these companies to actually decide whether or not they're going to keep us safe and to balance that up against their growth and their profit, because they will always choose their growth and profit over our lives, because they've proven it time and time again.
Rashad, we're going to bring in a second guest to join you right now. Rashad Robinson, of course, is with Color of Change. Saturday's massacre by the 18-year-old white supremacist, which killed 10, has been called a made-for-the-internet massacre. And the shooter streaming the massacre on Twitch for about 2 minutes. As Rashad pointed out, it's owned by Amazon before Twitch took it down. Users of hate-filled online message boards like 4chan soon shared the video. It was being watched by 22 people, and now it's been watched by millions. For more, we're joined by journalist and author Talia Levin, who spent nearly a year impersonating right-wing white supremacists online, assuming false identities to infiltrate their groups as she worked on her book Culture Warlords, My Journey into the Dark Web of White Supremacy. Talia, welcome to Democracy Now! In the process of writing your book, you also explored the relationship between the extreme right and conservatives in the United States, in the mainstream, which you write about in your new piece for Rolling Stone, headlined, "The Buffalo Shooter Isn't a Lone Wolf. He's a Mainstream Republican." Take us through your response to what happened and your journey through the dark web. But as you said, it doesn't just exist there in 4chan and 8chan and the Dylann Roof groups, those who praise the killer and the Mother Emanuel Church and others. Take us on that journey you took.
I mean, I think it's important to note that the shooter was radicalized, according to his, you know, his manifesto and other writings anyway, online. You know, he was steeped in this ecosystem, which I know pretty well, unfortunately. I would say that it exists in parallel to and has grown ever closer to what I call the sort of white hot center of Republican politics. And the commonality is this fixation on white dominance, this fixation on white fertility, this, you know, the demographics of the United States are changing. It has been clear for some time now that there will be a time, that is drawing closer, just due to the sort of fluctuation of births and deaths and, you know, some level of immigration that's been, you know, consistently restricted, where the U.S. will be a majority minority country, no longer a quote white country. And to me, it's important to note that demographic change in and of itself is a moral neutral, but it has been the subject of this moral panic, this intense moral panic, this imputation of existential threat, both in the extremist white supremacist movement and now increasingly over the past half decade throughout the Republican Party, to the point where it is really a consuming sentiment in the central institutions of the Republican Party and its media arms. So, you know, you have this logic of sort of an existential struggle for survival of the white race that's utterly consumed the top line, of the Republican Party, and also is the central preoccupation of far right extremists who do not claim Republican affiliation, far from it. They consider themselves outside the two-party system, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, to me, it was striking how closely the shooter's rhetoric mirrored that of, stuff we're seeing from Republican officials and candidates and right-wing pundits.
I wanted to ask you about the youthfulness of some of these killers perpetrating these massacres. I mean, Dylann Roof was 21 when he engaged in the Charleston massacre. Patrick Wood Crucius in El Paso in 2019 was 21. Now this shooter, 18. Your experience in terms of the impact on young people of these neo-Nazi and ultra-right replacement theory views?
Yeah, I also wanted to just, while I have a megaphone, talk about what replacement theory is. It's also known as the white genocide theory. It's this idea that, again, it takes this idea of demographic change and instead of positing it as morally neutral, talks about, or sort of the natural ways populations change over time, postulate that it's a sinister plot being engineered, and the white supremacists will explicitly say that they believe it's engineered by Jews. That was the direct motivation of the Pittsburgh synagogue shooter. Mainstream Republicans will talk about quote unquote elites or globalists or, Democrats, right? For electoral advantage. But the sort of conspiracy element of it is that this is a deliberately engineered and sinister and nefarious demographic change. As to the youthfulness of the perpetrators, I mean, I think it's important to understand white supremacist extremism as like any other human endeavor. It's driven by narrative. It's driven by emotion and story. What it appeals to emotionally, and it often sort of is perpetuated in these youth-oriented online spaces. Pitches itself as very edgy, this ideology. The mechanisms it uses for recruitment are sort of these edgy jokes that aren't really jokes. crude machismo, the sort of ability to engage in sort of online harassment and cruelty, without compunction, right? But the story that it tells is very much a story in which, you can be a hero, you can fight for the white race, you can belong to something bigger, your life can have a purpose. If you take up arms, if you spill blood for the white race, you'll be a hero. You'll be a saint, is the term they regularly use for white supremacist mass shooters. And that was the term that, you know, Peyton Gedrin, the Buffalo Shooter, also employed in his online writings in describing, you know, previous perpetrators of massacres. So, you know, when you think about who does this sort of like dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, like, you know, it is good and sweet to die for your race, say, who does this rhetoric appeal to? You know, I think it's natural that it would appeal in the most actionable way, you know, to young men who are more prone to take up a call to arms.
So, Talia, I wanted to interrupt for a second to ask you, because what I was so struck by in Culture Warlords and your really deeply researched book, personally researched, I mean, you were so well known on Twitter before this, you were at Media Matters, you've been monitoring the extreme right. You were the target of so much vitriol, you know, online, you were threatened with rape endless times, yet your bravery in staying there, also adopting a new persona. But I think so many people don't even understand what 4chan and 8chan are. He said he was so influenced, this shooter, by 4chan. And even though the Amazon company Twitch, only 22 people were viewing, very soon at 4chan, they took it up, even though it was replaced by, it was removed by Twitch. And now millions are viewing this. Those places you went to, not to say it all lives there now because the swamp has become mainstream, but take us there to the Dylann Roof groups, even today.
Yeah, I mean, these spaces, you know, you have your, like 4chan, there are certain communities on Discord. At this point, a lot of it has migrated to an app called Telegram, which is an encrypted messaging app that enables, you know, sort of public channels, private channels, the posting of video and audio. And so it's a very useful, you know, mechanism to spread propaganda. One way I describe these online spaces is sort of perpetual motion radicalization machines. They are essentially megaphones for stochastic terror that operate 24 hours a day, you know, where people who are already radicalized or in the process of becoming radicalized can imbibe propaganda, can imbibe video of violence, can imbibe, you know, all kinds of racist screeds, including those from decades and centuries past. You know, they're passing PDFs of Mein Kampf and the Turner Diaries and these other radicalized texts. You know, they're constantly spreading racist memes. So it's really, once you have sort of entered these spaces, you are then subject to sort of this gushing, consistent fountain of vitriol that, you know, slowly, like any other form of propaganda, you know, shapes your worldview. It shapes an apocalyptic worldview, a worldview, you know, that again, just like consistently posits the necessity for violence over and over again, 24 hours a day. I mean, it's really remarkable how relentless the surge of propaganda is, you know, when you enter these spaces. And the function, you know, the reason why these videos, the same was true of the Christchurch mosque shooter. You know, his live streamed video of his massacre was, you know, taken down, by millions. You know, because these videos have significant propaganda value. You know, the visceral thrill of sort of almost in a video game like way watching people die. This has significant propaganda value, and every time an attack is successful and widely publicized, it lowers the barrier for the next one.
I'd like to bring in Rashad Robinson again. Rashad, you've had numerous conversations with some of these tech company executives. Could you talk about your discussions with them about this issue of racism and white supremacy and hate speech online? What's their response? And what do you think needs to be done concretely in coming months and years to address this problem?
Well, you know, my conversations oftentimes with them starts with them being, you know, deeply concerned, feeling very bad about the situation, saying that they're working hard. And oftentimes Recognizing that there are people inside of these platforms who are working hard, who are trying sort of at the edges and even, you know, within very challenging circumstances to fix these problems. The challenge is the model itself. And even while these folks will say that they care and they want to work, they're unwilling to actually deal with the business model because they are not forced to. And so, you know, some of the hardest conversations we had with the social media platforms were in the summer of 2020. For instance, when Donald Trump posted that call to arms against protesters, the looters and shooters post on Facebook and Twitter. And, you know, it absolutely violated the four corners of the policies we had fought to put in place at Facebook. But instead of actually enforcing that policy against Donald Trump, Mark Zuckerberg calls Donald Trump to have a conversation with him and ends up leaving up that post. And when I ended up having a conversation with Mark going back and forth about it, they couldn't really sort of describe why they gave Donald Trump sort of an out, except to talk about it as sort of newsworthy. When, you know, trying to help them understand the history of vigilante violence, trying to help them understand the attacks on Black communities, trying to help them understand the calls to arms, made us once again recognize all of the ways in which the sort of attempts to get these companies to self-regulate are sort of futile. We actually need very clear rules, right? The algorithms should be more transparent at these companies. Government should be able to review them. We should actually understand what type of things get amplified and what type of things don't. There should be some sort of transparency. Researchers should have access to how these things work so that we can evaluate and we can find out if they're safe. These companies shouldn't have carte blanche. There are a whole set of things on the transparency front. Then there are a whole set of things on the business model front, from the ways in which targeted ads work on these platforms to the ways in which everything from recommendations. You go onto Twitter now and you maybe come across a white supremacist on Twitter, someone like Richard Spencer, who right now is still able to monetize on Twitter. And then you start getting served up more and more white supremacists, more and more white nationalists to actually follow. This is a design function at Twitter. This is choices they have made. These are choices that these platforms have made. And time again, they've been pushed and challenged on them. And they have chosen to do something different because the accountability, the consequences are not strong enough for them to do something different.
I want to thank you for being with us, Rashad and Talia. Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change, and Talia Levin, author of Culture Warlords. Next up, we look at monopolies and the baby formula shortage with David Dayan of the American Prospect. Stay with us. Where are we going? by Marvin Gaye. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. With a nation facing a critical shortage of baby formula, we look now at the role of monopolies. The Biden administration's announced plans to alleviate the crisis as the Food and Drug Administration and Abbott Laboratories says it's reached an agreement to allow Abbott to reopen the nation's largest baby formula plant. The plant had been closed due to concerns over bacterial contamination months after a whistleblower alerted the FDA to alleged safety lapses and then was fired. Multiple babies became sick after eating formula from that plant. Two babies died. Meanwhile, the FDA has eased import rules on baby formula made overseas, and the American Academy of Pediatrics has said babies as young as 6 months old can now be fed cow's milk for a brief period of time due to the baby formula shortage. Until recently, pediatricians had recommended babies not be fed cow's milk until they're at least a year old. This is White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre responding Monday to questions about the shortage.
Throughout the weekend, we've been working closely with manufacturers and retailers to identify transportation and logistical needs to increase the amount and spread of FDA-approved formula being shipped into the country and ensure that formula is quickly moving from factories to retailers. The president understands. He gets this. He gets how stressful it is for parents trying to feed their children, which is why we're leaving no stone unturned.
For more, we're joined by David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect. He writes about the four companies that sell almost all baby formula in the United States. In his new piece, headlined "The Age of Rationing, From Pandemic Supply Chain Snarls to Baby Formula Shortages, We Forgot That Physical Production Isn't Magic and We Need to Engineer It for Stability." So let's start with this real catastrophe right now for parents with babies across the country. And the whole issue of monopoly, starting with the whistleblower who alerted the company and the FDA. And the response? The whistleblower was fired. Two babies die. We're talking about months ago before we got to this point where the shelves are bare for everyone.
Yeah, the whistleblower first alerted the company internally and then alerted the FDA. This was way back last October. This facility in Sturgis, Michigan, produces about 20% of the nation's supply of formula. So obviously, if you take that offline, you're going to have a problem. It's magnified even more by the market structure and the way that formula is sold. But just alone, if you take one out of every five boxes of formula off the shelves, while this is investigated, you're going to have a problem of getting supply into the places that you need.
And David, how did we get to this point that four companies, it seems almost every major industry in America today, there's three or four companies that monopolize or control the supply. How did we get to this point in terms of baby formula?
Yeah, I would argue it's even worse in the baby formula industry. There are really two large conglomerates, Abbott Labs, which makes Similac and also, you know, produces medical devices, and Reckitt Benckiser, which is the creator of Enfamil, the other major brand. And they're mostly known for making Lysol. They're a UK company that makes a whole bunch of consumer goods. They're really the giants. About two-thirds of the market is in the hands of those two companies. Nestle through the Gerber brand and Perrigo, which makes store brands, they have a little sliver. But the reason is that we have a program called Women, Infants, and Children, the WIC program. And about half of all formula passes through that program that goes to poor families. And it's very well intentioned. You get very large discounts the government gets for purchasing formula and then getting it on to poor families. But they do this in a way that says that each state does a competitive bidding process with a formula company. And in exchange for those volume discounts, they get market exclusivity. So if you go to the state of Michigan, the state of California, state of Oregon, there's only one company that if you're a WIC recipient, you can actually buy and get that formula for free. So other competitors of that, you know, dominant company, whether it's in the WIC program or not, you're not going to put stuff on the shelves if half of your customers can't buy it. So what you end up having is these little monopolies in all 50 states. And that's because of the structure of the WIC program, which gives this exclusive sole source contract in exchange for a discount.
And while everyone is focused on baby formula, can you talk about Abbott Labs and what other crucial products for children are also being disrupted right now?
I mean, Abbott Labs makes a whole host of other medical devices and healthcare products. Of course, we were reminded at the beginning of the year that Abbott Labs was one of the two companies that was allowed to make COVID-19 tests in this country. And they were, as we all remember, when there was a surge in COVID cases at the beginning of the year, there was a shortage of that equipment. Last year, Abbott Labs shut down its facility for making COVID tests because of low demand. So there wasn't a stockpile. And as a result, when cases surged and people wanted the at-home tests, they weren't readily available. And so this speaks to sort of a desire to cut costs over creating some redundancy, some resiliency, some inventory on the part of Abbott. And on the part of the government itself, frankly, it's led to a lot of problems throughout the healthcare space.
So the answer for President Biden is to allow in foreign baby formula companies in this crisis. There was a discussion last week of invoking the Defense Production Act. You wrote the book Monopolize, Life in the Age of Corporate Power. What do you think needs further to happen so we're not going to see something like this again? And also just the outrage of there being a whistleblower, how the FDA plays in this, because they went to the FDA, they went to Abbott, they were just fired.
Yeah, I mean, and if you read the complaint between the FDA and Abbott, you'll find that traces of this bacteria that ended up killing these two babies was found in Abbott products in 2019 and in 2020. So obviously there were a lot of problems at this lab in Sturgis, Michigan, and the FDA needs to do just a much better job of monitoring all this. So that's number one. Number two, I think you need to overhaul this WIC program and not create this situation where you have 50 dominant little mini monopolies throughout the country for formula. It makes the whole system far less resilient. And if there's one shock, basically, you end up with this kind of crisis. 34 states. Abbott holds that WIC contract, and the states in which supply is most in shortage right now correspond to the states where Abbott holds that contract. So that's clearly the problem. There are several ways to go about it. One is, you know, you just sort of, if you want to do this market with WIC, where poor families get these discounts, and it's very important that they do, you could make that a government program and let private companies on the non-WIC side of the market compete with one another. The other option is that instead of hiving off for the poor each purchase that they have to make, so that they have to get a WIC program for formula and they need food stamps for food and they need a housing voucher for housing, you could just sort of give a larger cash benefit and let families figure out what they need on their own and not hive these things off and create these problems with the overall market.
David, we only have a minute left, but I wanted to turn to another topic. Are there primary elections happening today in several states, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Idaho, Kentucky? What you're looking for in terms of these coming elections?
Yeah, there are several major states in which you've seen these large outside groups, corporate money, come into these races and move in on the side of a centrist candidate running against a progressive. Summer Lee, the progressive candidate in the Pittsburgh area in Pennsylvania, that's an important House race. There are two House races in North Carolina that experience this. Largely, you have these PACs like AIPAC. You have this one PAC called Protect Our Future, which is bankrolled by a crypto billionaire. They're all coming in, and there's just this tremendous amount of money that's being pumped into these races. And we'll see if progressives can survive this onslaught in these particular races in Pennsylvania, North Carolina. There's also a couple in Oregon that are interesting to look at. So that's really what I'm looking at.
And the Senate race in Pennsylvania that has getting a lot of attention. Three candidates could have all been supported by Trump, but he supported one.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens. Kathy Barnett, the who was apparently at January 6th and is, espoused some really dangerous rhetoric. She is surging right now. Dr. Oz is the former TV star that's been endorsed by Trump. And then you have David McCormick, a hedge fund billionaire who's spent millions of dollars of his own money in this race. So we'll see what happens on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, it looks like John Fetterman will be the candidate on for the Democrats.
Although he did have a stroke last week. We'll leave it there, but pick it up tomorrow. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, David Day, and thank you.